Okay, lecture 11. Today we will discuss photophysics and photoelectron spectroscopy. Okay, here we go. Right. Okay, so today we have quite much material, so let's get to the business. Photophysical and photochemical processes. In fact, we are mostly talking about photophysical processes. So now the difference to spectroscopy is that here we are interested in what happens after excitation. So basically in spectroscopy, we are interested in what kind of transitions we have. And now after transition, molecule is excited and it relaxes. And if we wait long enough, everything has returned to the ground state and energy has been dissipated in various ways. Unless there is photochemical process where, and then chemistry can happen. But so we describe these processes with this kind of diagrams, and it looks a bit complicated, but so let's go through. In most of the time, when you see these diagrams, they only show the thick lines. So for example, S0 as a thick line, and then we have S1, a thick line, and S2, and T1. And they are the electronic states. And as you may remember, S refers to singlet state, and the number index is the energy order. S0 is the ground singlet state, S1 is the first excited singlet state, S2 is the second excited singlet state, and so on. And T is a triplet state, T1 is the first triplet state. Most of the time, you only draw these and arrows between them. But here, in order to illustrate what really happens, there are also the vibrational states. So they are the thinner lines. And then, so of course, we have all the vibrational states for all the electronic states. So we have lots of states. And here we are interested in various processes. And this is a typical scheme what can happen. So first of all, we have absorption. And as you can see, that goes up to the S2, so to the second excited singlet state, and to some vibrational excited state of it. So this is a transition to maybe some vibronic state of S2. And now, and this is something you can observe in the spectrum. So you can record absorption spectrum, and you see this transition there. But when you do the excitation, what happens is described by the wavy arrows. And first of all, we have process which is labeled IVR, intramolecular vibration redistribution. Did I write it? Yeah, here. That means that the vibrational energy will be relaxing. So we come down to the bottom of the S2 state. So basically to the lowest vibrational state. And this IVR means that vibrations will be, molecule will undergo different transitions among vibrational states. And finally, it will dissipate the vibrational energy to the surrounding as a heat. So we lose energy now here and go to the bottom of S2 state. So now the molecule is on the ground electronic state. So what can happen? It is excited and energy can dissipate. Now what can happen? It can go to S1 state, but it doesn't jump right away to the bottom of S1 state, but actually it goes horizontally to the S1 state. And then it goes to some of the excited vibrational state of S1 state. And in this case, it is energetically resonant process. So it can jump from S2 to S1 state, but because S1 state is lower, then some vibrationally excited state will be excited for the S1 state. And this process jump between two electronic states of the same spin multiplicity is called internal conversion, IC. So now molecule jumps from S2 state to S1 state, and it gets vibrationally excited. And again, IVR happens, and the molecule finds itself on the bottom of the S1 state, so basically not vibrationally excited. So intramolecular vibration redistribution again happens, and finally the molecule gives away its energy as a heat to the surroundings. So what happens now? Molecule is on the bottom of S1 state. It is still excited, so it can still relax. Now it has two possibilities. It can undergo another internal conversion to the ground electronic state, S1, S0. And if that happens, S0 will be highly vibrationally excited, and then it dissipates energy via vibrational relaxation again. And then finally it goes to the S0 state and returns to the ground state. But it can take another path. It can go to the right. So basically, it can jump to T1 state, so triplet state. And that is a spin forbidden process formally, and it is called intersystem crossing. And again, it doesn't jump right away to the bottom, but T1 state gets vibrationally excited. And then IVR happens again, and the molecule finds itself on the bottom of the T1 state. It's still excited. So what can happen? It could jump back to the S0, and that would be another inter-system crossing, but it can relax via phosphorescence. So then we will finally see phosphorescence emission, and then it returns to the S0 state. Going back to S1 state, of course, it can also relax to the ground electronic state via fluorescence. So here we see various ways for energy relaxation. We have intramolecular vibration redistribution, then various jumps, internal conversion, intersystem crossing. And these are non-radiated processes or radiation-less. There is no radiation. It is pure, basically, mechanical relaxation. And in this case, energy is dissipated in surroundings as heat, molecular motion. And then we have radiated processes, fluorescence and phosphorescence. And all these mechanisms. Yes.
Have we ever been able to, or is there any method to stop the relaxation process in one of these states? For example, if there is absorption, it goes to S2 state, and then we stop, for example, radiating the sample, and it doesn't, like, it should relax, but it doesn't. Is there like any way to do that?
Not really.
Yes.
These are basically natural intrinsic processes. In particular, things like internal conversion, jump to another electronic state, this is something you cannot affect. So it happens with a specific rate. We can affect them a little bit. For example, this intramolecular vibration redistribution. Finally, a molecule gives out its energy to the surroundings. And then the rate of that process depends on, for example, the solvent, what solvent we have. But it is, I would say, small tuning. It doesn't stop it. The rate can change. But all these processes are basically intrinsic for the molecule, especially if the molecule is in a gas phase. So then it's always the same. And these rates are characteristic for the molecule, and we can measure the rates, and then they are really intrinsic processes. So we really cannot stop them. That is a good question. Okay, so basically, it's interesting that when the molecule is on the ground state and then you make excitation, a lot of things happen. Energy is funneled to different vibrational modes and electronic states and so on, and there can be multiple steps and there can be radiation. And finally, the molecule returns on the ground state and it looks like nothing happened. Of course, all this can happen very fast. We know that phosphorescence can take a long time, so T1 state can be very long-lived, but all the other processes are very fast and can happen in few nanoseconds or microseconds. Very often in these diagrams, the IVR step is not shown. So basically, we will see later. But for example, jump from S2 to S1 is shown by an arrow from S2 to S1. And this emphasizes the fact that IVR is very fast. So for example, if we jump from S2 to S1, it very rapidly goes down to S0. So it means that you can basically approximate this process by jump from S2 bottom to S1 bottom. But in reality, there is this step. You first go here, and then there is very rapid IVR. IVR happens in picosecond time scale. So picosecond is 10 to minus 12 seconds. It's very, very fast. So all these processes have different time scales, and today we are going to go through these time scales to understand roughly what kind of time scales we are talking about. And studying these processes has very much evolved in technical development of methods. So basically, lifetimes of electronic states, for example, fluorescence lifetimes on your nanoseconds. So after development of nanosecond pulse lasers, it was possible to study these processes in real time. And then the IVR is a picosecond time scale. So femtosecond spectroscopy, picosecond spectroscopy was needed to see in real time these relaxation processes. Okay, so basically we have radiationless or non-radiative processes, vibration and relaxation, and jump between the electronic states. Internal conversion is a spin allowed jump, and inter-system crossing is a spin forbidden. And then we have radiative processes, fluorescence and phosphorescence. Okay, so of course, going to radiative processes, first of all, we have studied radiative processes in absorption and emission, but just let's take a new look into that. So this is a very typical absorption and emission spectra of organic aromatic compound anthracene. And here on the left, we have absorption with solid line and fluorescence in dotted or dashed line. And on the right hand side, this is now magnified. You see the scale is different. Epsilon max is 10 to minus 4 on the right hand side, and on the left, 10 to 4. So this on the right, we have a phosphorescent spectrum. And even the absorption spectrum, which is very weak for singlet to triplet transitions. So on the left, we have allowed radiative transitions, absorption and fluorescence, and on the right, you have singlet triplet transitions. They are much, much weaker. But you see that they look almost like mirror image of each other. And but they are not exactly mirror image. And down here we see the interpretation of the spectra. And if we start from the left side of the absorption spectrum, the first peak, and then the emission spectrum, the first peak of the emission spectrum almost overlaps with this. So this is clearly the 0-0 transition, because absorption spectrum suddenly starts from there. So this is the first possible transition. So that is a 0-0 vibronic transition. And then when you go to the right, the next peak is 0-1, then 0-2, 0-3, and 0-4. So we can draw them here on the diagram, 0-0. We can 0-1, 0. Sorry, I said wrong. The absorption is the dashed line and emission is the solid line. You can see it from the scale, so that the higher energy transitions are absorption and lower energy emission. Yes, the absorption is the dashed line. So up to 0-4, and then we can see that this vibrational structure originates from vibrational level structure on the upper electronic state, okay? And then for the fluorescent spectrum, the first peak, which almost overlaps with the absorption spectrum, must be the same transition, 0-0. So it is basically emission from the bottom of the S1 state in this case to the zero state. And then the next peaks are 01, 02, 03, 04. Okay? And why it looks like mirror image is that we have same transitions, but so it should look similar, but there is difference because in absorption, the level structure comes from the excited electronic state, and in emission, the level structure comes from ground electronic state. So as long as these vibrations are similar, so they have similar frequencies, it should look like mirror image, but it's not exactly mirror image. If we calculate exactly the positions, there will be difference in frequency. But this is a typical case that they look like mirror image. Same for the phosphorescence and single triplet transition, because the same thing there. But now we just absorption goes to T1 and emission goes from T1 to S0. Note that scale is very, very different. This is really many orders of magnitude weaker than the allowed transition. Now, there is already something important here that you can recognize, which is that what it is understandable that we have mostly or only transitions from the ground vibrational state of the ground electronic state, because higher electronic states are not much populated. But note that here we seem to have emission also from the zero vibrational state of excited electronic state. It wouldn't have to be so, because we could have many states populated. But this reflects the fact that the IVR, intramolecular vibrational redistribution, is so fast that in very fast time after excitation, all the molecules relax to the ground vibrational state. And we mainly see emission from the zero state. Okay. So this is basically called mirror image principle, that absorption and emission look almost like mirror image, but they are not quite the same. But whenever you see this kind of spectra now in absorption and emission, you can try to assign these transitions. And in this case, it's very easy because the absorption starts suddenly. We have this kind of progression of vibrational state, but the first peak is very well recognizable. We already talked slightly about Stokes shift. So quite often we don't see so well this vibronic structure, and usually we have this kind of spectra that I'm showing here. And in general, we talk about difference in maxima of absorption and emission and refer it to as a Stokes shift. So maximum of absorption is a different point than maximum of emission. And you can understand it from this previous picture here. Why it is so. Yes. Now, there is another shift. We also discussed this during the last lecture, that if we look carefully, this overlapping transition, the first 0-0 transition, it is not quite exactly the same position in absorption and emission. And this is due to this dynamic solvent shift, which is because the solvent equilibrium configuration is different for absorption than for fluorescence. And that can be seen very nicely here if you can resolve individual vibronic peaks, then you can directly measure this difference between these peaks, and then that gives us this dynamic solvent shift. So these are some interesting details we can see from the spectra. Now, there's a very important quantity called quantum yield. And quantum yield tells us what is the fraction or efficiency of a certain relaxation pathway. So what percentage of molecules undergo certain relaxation pathway? Because molecules take multiple pathways. So basically, we can describe it as a ratio of photons out per photons in. So that means that how many photons are absorbed and how many photons are emitted. So this here, for this quantum yield, we can define quantum yield for different processes, and here it is defined for emission process. So it means that we see how many photons are emitted per absorbed photons. And for example, if you are developing fluorescent markers for bioimaging, you would like to maximize this fluorescence quantum yield so that it's very efficiently relaxes via fluorescent pathway. And this is something we can measure. Now we come to rate constant concept. So general expression for quantum yield for emission can be written in this way, and let me explain. So when we have these processes,
like here, S0, S1, this is absorption, and then we can have fluorescence, for example, let this be fluorescence. Let this be T1. Now I'm drawing them like this, right? And this would be intersystem crossing. Then we can describe these different processes with rate. So how many moles per second are going certain pathway? And then we can give a rate constant. So we can have a rate constant for intersystem crossing. We can have rate constant for fluorescence. We have another process, we have internal conversion. So we can have a rate constant for internal conversion. And if we know these rate constants, we know how the molecule relaxes. And now here we have a general expression for quantum yield, and that is the ratio of rate constant for the process in question. So this is a rate constant for emission, and divided by sum of all possible relaxation rate constants. So we have an emission rate constant plus sum of all possible other rate constants that deactivate the state. Here, for example, if we have these three processes, this is fluorescence, so this could be fluorescence quantum yield. That would be KF divided by KF plus KIC plus KISC. And then, but we have to multiply with the phi star, which is the formation efficiency of the emitting state. And if we excite directly this state, it is one. But we come to soon to other processes where it is not one. So we can write it in this way, that is the formation efficiency times now KE0, emission rate constant, times tau, which is the lifetime of the emitting state. Because lifetime is the inverse of sum of all deactivating rate constants. And what is nice here is that lifetime is something we can measure. We can perform pulsed experiment. We use short pulse, we excite the molecules, and we observe fluorescence decay. And from the decay of fluorescence, we can determine the lifetime of the state. So that is something we can measure. So we can, via lifetime, we can know the sum of all the activating rate constants. Okay, so now if we give phi star value of one, so it means that we directly excite the emitting state, then, for example, for the fluorescence quantum yield, we can write this way. If, for example, we neglect all other non-related processes and intersystem crossing, sometimes it is like that. As an example, then the fluorescence quantum yield would be this ratio. And now we can denominator, we can write in terms of the tau, which is a lifetime of the single state. So we have a simple relation that the fluorescence quantum yield is equal to rate constant for fluorescence times lifetime of the state.
And here we start to see that tau is something we can measure, and in fact also quantum yield can be measured. So if we can measure this and we can measure this, we can determine the fluorescence rate constant. Or opposite, if we not determine the fluorescence rate constant, otherwise we can determine one of these. So the task here is that we would like to be able to measure this rate constant. If we know that, and if we can measure the rate constant, we know exactly what happens to the molecule after excitation, all the time scales and everything. So the quantum yield can vary a lot. And for fluorescence, it typically varies between 1 and 10 to minus 4. If it's 1, it means that all the relaxation, this is basically all the relaxes in general. Of course, it's never exactly 1, but it can be close. If it's 10 to minus 4, it's almost dark. So almost all the relaxation goes via non-radiative pathways. And for fluorescent molecules, which I use, for example, in bioimaging, the quantum yield is typically several tenths of percent. It could be 50%, 60%, and they are very efficient and can be used for imaging. What about phosphorescence? Now, as you can see here, first of all, so for example, here P1 would be the state that emits phosphorescence, and we have rate constant for phosphorescence. Okay, so we would like to determine the rate quantum yield for phosphorescence. Now you see that normally we don't excite this state directly because it's extremely weak transition, and then if we go via S1, so we excite S1 and we rely on intersystem crossing for population of P1 state. And in this case, we first have to multiply this equation with phi ST, which is a quantum yield for singlet triplet. So quantum yield for molecule to go from S1 state to P1. So that is the idea of efficiency of formation of the emitting state. Maybe it's, for example, 20%. So at least from all excitation, 20% would end up in T1. So that is the first factor we have. And then we have the rate constant for phosphorescence divided by sum of all deactivating. The rate constants for all the activating processes for the T state. And there we have phosphorescence rate constant plus first sum is now general KD, which means that all the activating rate constants here, it would basically be K intersystem crossing from T1 to S1. And basically nothing else. So KIST or KP. But additionally, we have one more term here now, and that is sum of KQ times concentration of Q. And this is a new term, and that is a quenching process. And that's why we have the concentration here, concentration of quenching. That means the quenching can happen when we have a triplet state molecule in a solution and another molecule comes. Typically, it is oxygen, dissolved oxygen, and they meet and excited molecule can transfer its energy to the oxygen molecule and be deactivated. So this is a quenching process. And why we have it here and not for the singlet? In principle, it also occurs for singlet, but since the singlet state is short-lived, there is really not much time to meet other molecules. in a solution. But when the triplet state is very long lived, it has a lot of time to go in a solution and need these quencher molecules. So that's why for triplet state, this is more important. But altogether, then we can express this quantum yield as a now quantum yield for single triplet transition, and then times phosphorescence rate constant times lifetime of the triplet state. So anyway, this inverse of all these deactivated rate constant is still the lifetime of the triplet state. Okay. Now, so this quencher is something we can manipulate. So of course it depends on whether we have some kind of quenching molecule. And as I mentioned, typically there is a very common quencher molecule, which is oxygen. And whenever you have any solvent, any liquid, it can be water, but it can be organic solvents, there will be, if you keep it in atmosphere, there will be dissolved oxygen there. So there's a certain concentration. So, and then if you want to measure your phosphorescence, it can happen that this quenches the phosphorescence. So if you want to really measure this phosphorescence, you may have to get rid of quencher molecules. And that can mean that you either have to pump out oxygen, or you can bubble, for example, argon or nitrogen gas through the liquid so that you get rid of the oxygen. And I will show you an example. The second idea is that if we freeze your sample, if it's not a liquid but in solid matrix, then your molecules don't move anymore and you don't have to worry about these encounters, and then this quenching can be eliminated. Okay, for example, now referring to this picture I have on the blackboard, there we could write this equation in this way. So now this neglects this quenching process, because for example, if you refer to solid matrices, we can neglect that. And the only other deactivating channel would be triplet singlet. Let me rephrase. It is better to write triplet singlet, because then it distinguishes from this process, from single triplet. We could also write this as a single triplet. So these both are intersystem crossing processes, but now we can distinguish single to triplet or triplet to single. So we see that for the triplet state, we have two possible relaxation channels, KPS or KP, and then the equation would be simple like this. Okay, so, but if we are in liquids, we can have this quenching, and it turns out that the concentration of quenchers should be lower than something like 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 7 molar. So it should be quite low. And here is an example of the effect of oxygen. So on the left, we have biacetyl in hexane. And the first emission spectrum is shown as a dotted line that is aerated, so in air. And you see only this emission around 450 to 500 nanometers. But if you bubble your sample with nitrogen, which removes oxygen, you see the solid line spectrum. And you see that it's tremendously different from the spectrum in air. And it is because there is a large quantum yield for intersystem crossing. So fluorescence is not particularly strong, but phosphorescence is very strong. And but in order to see that, you have to get rid of the quenchers, which you can do by nitrogen purge. Okay. Second example on the right, one for dibromonaphthalene in acetonitrile solvent. And again, same thing, dotted line is aerated, so normal. And you see the fluorescence band. but you don't see the phosphorescence band. But if you nitrogen perfuse, you get a new band, quite strong phosphorescence. So that is essential to take into account when you're studying the phosphorescence processes. Next, we talk about new type of excited state molecule, which is absorption complex or exiplex. And it is that when we have excited molecule, very often excited molecule has a stronger interaction with other molecules than the ground state. And they can form a pair, bound pair, and that pair has a different kind of emission characteristics than molecule itself. So when two or more molecules take part in absorption or emission process in a cooperative manner, so they form a complex, we call it exiplex, excited complex, exiplex. You can also see eximer when the molecules have the same identity, it's an excited dimer, so excimer. And there are characteristic features when this kind of process happens. You observe a new absorption band, which does not exist for either molecule alone, but only for together. Or new emission band, same thing. And the dependence of the intensity of the absorption or emission band on the concentration is evident for both molecules. So this is something. When you increase the concentration, it grows in. If you go to highly diluted, when the molecules don't really find each other anymore, then you get to a situation when excimer formation is eliminated. And this is a diagram showing what is happening. So now upstairs we have potential energy curves for ground state, low on the low, and excited state. And now this potential energy curves refer to the supermolecule complex. So it is a coordinate where we have a between two molecules, not internal coordinate, but two molecules. And when we look at the lower curve, we basically see only repulsion. When the molecules get close to each other, you cannot push them together, so we have repulsion. So there is no bound state, or if there is, it's weakly bound, like van der Waals minimum. But upstairs, we have excited molecule, and they form a fairly strongly bound state. And we have molecules labeled A and D. And if you excite one of them, they form a strongly bound complex. So they get together, they are bound. Now, what happens is that if we are on the left side where the molecules are far apart each other, they don't know about each other, then we have a characteristic spectra of monomer absorption and emission. But when they get close to each other, we can have a new band, especially in emission, because if they form the complex, they get into the minimum, and then from there we get emission, which ends up on the repulsive part of the potential, and that forms a broad band at very different energy, at low energy than isolated molecules. And that is exiplex emission. And here is an example, pyrene, aromatic molecule, it forms eximer. So the dimer, strongly bound dimer, and this series of spectra at different concentrations show what is happening. So we start from the low concentration, 0.01 millimolar. And we get, so this is a fluorescent spectrum, typical vibronic structure. And if we go to 0.1 millimolar, it's about the same. But if you go to 1 millimolar, in addition to normal spectrum, a new band appears at longer wavelengths. And when we increase the concentration, it grows and grows and grows, and it is at 10 millimolar, it is dominant band in the spectrum. So this is the Exitrix fluorescence. So you can see that this is very prominent, it's nothing small. So it is shows that there is excited state complex forming. So it is fairly common phenomenon, it's good to know about it. Now, so these examples were about radiated transits, fluorescence and phosphorescence. Now let's think about non-radiated transitions. So in non-radiated transition, the electronic energy is converted to kinetic energy. So, you know, electronic energy is basically potential energy of higher energy configuration of electrons. And that is converted to kinetic energy of nuclei, so vibrations. And we have this classical interpretation where radiationless transition or non-radiated transition between electronic states happens as a jump between potential energy surfaces. So, and typically, usually jump takes place at the minima of the excited state surface. So now we try to investigate what is the principle behind these non-radiated transitions. And it appears that there is exactly similar Frank Condon principle as for radiated transitions. So this is very important. So now, so here is the, on the left, this is a situation which describes the situation. So we have a lower potential energy curve, lower state and upper state, and they are now situated in this way. So if we start from the excited state molecule, and this is now a classical thinking, so we could describe this as a molecule going oscillatory motion between A and B. And now when the non-radiative relaxation happens, the molecule should jump from this potential curve to the lower one, but that has to be, because it's a fast electronic transition, it should occur so that we don't lose energy. So we should end up and see B path on the lower potential energy curve. So it means that in this situation, if that would happen very rapidly, suddenly molecules should start to vibrate with much, much higher amplitude, and the position of the nucleus would change very rapidly. And that is not very prominent, because position and momentum of nucleus would not change in this extremely rapid electronic process. So it should be slow process. And now I go to quantum mechanical interpretation, which I feel like more. And in fact, the rate for this process is proportional to the Frank Condon factor, exactly the same way as for the radiative transition. So we have the vibrational overlap integral and square of that. And that gives us the rate. Now we see on the left, we have this situation where the upper state minimum is at the same equilibrium distance as the lower state. And what happens is that we have to consider now the ground state vibrational wave function of the upper state and overlap of that with the highly vibrationally excited state wave function of the lower electronic state. And if you calculate the overlap, it's going to be almost zero, because we have this Gaussian function and highly oscillatory function. And I will, if you consider situation where you have this kind of function and then something like that, which goes from positive to negative, they almost cancel each other. So this is almost zero. The Frank Condon factor is very small. And that means that in this situation, this relaxation, non-radiative relaxation, should be slow. It doesn't really want to happen. But let's look at the situation on the right-hand side. Now they are displaced so that basically the potential energy curves cross. And now, if you remember, the vibrational wave functions for high states look like this. There is a high amplitude, and then it's a high oscillation like that, and then low like that. And now if we have a Gaussian function here, overlapping with this lobe, there will be a large Frank-Condon factor. So in this situation on the right, we have a good Frank-Condon factor, and we should have a fast jump from upper state to lower. So this illustrates the fact that these jumps between the states occur typically at the crossing points, when we have crossings between the potential and the curve. And if we don't have a crossing, we have so-called nested potentials, then this is slow process. And they can be very long lived. Now, so this is exactly the same principle as for the radiative transitions, but we just have to remember that jump occurs now so that energy don't, we don't lose energy. So we have to consider states at the same energy. Whereas you remember that in radiative transition, we do jump to different energy because we lose energy by photon. So, intersection of potential energy surfaces is important. Vibration and relaxation, I already told you that it's very fast. So in condensed space, typically the rate is about 10 to 12 per second. That means that lifetime is on the order of a picosecond. It's very, very fast. And now I have also told you that the electronic state lifetimes are typically in a nanosecond range, for example, for singlet states. That means that vibrational relaxation is about three orders of magnitude faster. And that kind of justifies this, that we use this kind of arrows that we jump. Because this way and this way, this is slow, this is very fast, so it's almost like jumping back at the bottom. Yes, and the process, vibrational relaxation process, occurs via two processes. First is vibrational, intramolecular vibrational redistribution, IVR. And that means that, for example, when we have a polyatomic molecule, if we excite in transition certain vibration, in vibronic transition, maybe we excite, let's say, carbonyl stretch. First, this carbonyl molecule will not stay in carbonyl stretch for long, but it will excite all kinds of vibrations. So all other vibrations will be excited in the molecule. And that is the redistribution of vibrational energy. So it doesn't stay long in a certain vibration. So it's the same thing as if you would take classical system like many balls and springs. And if you would just excite one ball spring system, very rapidly all the other springs and balls would be vibrating. Same thing. So the whole molecule will start vibrating. And after that, the energy, vibrational energy goes to the environment. And this is vibrational energy transfer. So vibrating molecule will give out its energy to surrounding molecule. And then basically the energy will dissipate to the solvent and finally cool down. So this is the schematic description. We have a certain excited vibration at one level. But then we have a multiple vibrational states, and there will be distribution of energy to those states, and finally to the environmental vibrational states, and that is basically continuum of states. Okay, so now I will show a couple of slides with several equations. There are many equations, but they are all almost the same, so there is a certain trend here. So the task here is that we would like to determine these rate constants for non-radiative transitions from emission parameters. So this is a general scheme. Now I have written, marked all the processes. The first I process is the initial excitation. Usually we can neglect that. But then we have the fluorescence and the rate constant for fluorescence, KF, and then zero, which is used to mark radiative process. Then we have KIC, internal conversion. Then we have KST from singlet to triplet. KTS from tip to singlet and KB0 first bracket. So we have basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different rate constants to determine. And they are not independent. So the rates, so this is like chemical kinetics, but the rates of processes, for example, S1 to S0, the rate for that process is rate constant KIC times concentration of molecules or population in S1 state. And rate for S1 to T1 is, again, rate constant times the population on the initial state, and so on. So it's a same logic for all of them. So the rate constants are the key points here. And now we can write equation for quantum yields for all these processes in exactly the same way. Quantum yield for fluorescence is the ratio of rate constants. So the upstairs is the processing question, the fluorescence rate constant, and downstairs we have all possible rate constants. And here you see that fluorescence originates from S1 state, and we have 1, 2, 3 possible deactivating states, and then we have downstairs some of all these. And the same logic for all. Internal conversion, same thing, KIC divided by sum of all possible rate constants. Same for FIST, and now for phosphorescence and triplet singlet, we have the same thing, but we have to multiply by this quantum yield for ST, because that tells us how much population goes to the T1 state in the first place. You get this? Yeah. And now we can write these. So, okay. So that is a general principle how to write these equations. So it's not useful to try to memorize it, but to remember the principle. So when I draw this diagram, now with this principle that quantum yield is a rate constant for the process in question divided by sum of all possible rate constants at the activated state. Now you can write all these equations. Okay, now remember that the inverse of sum of deactivating rate constants is a lifetime. So we can write that singlet lifetime, tau s, is according to this equation, and triplet lifetime is according to this equation. And now this is a true lifetime. This is something you can observe. So if you observe what is the how your molecule relaxes, you can measure this lifetime. We also define radiative lifetime. This is something we discussed in the first lectures. So this is a radiative lifetime, which is inverse of just the radiating rate constant. This is important because you can actually calculate radiative lifetime from absorption spectrum, for example, or yeah, basically from absorption spectrum. So this is something, again, we can determine from spectroscopic data. Okay. And now, with this information, we can rewrite these quantum yield expressions by using the lifetime of the states. So they look much simpler. And the point here is that really we can start determining these different parameters here. If we measure the lifetime and we measure the quantum yield, we can determine the radiative rate constant. And then by using different relations, we can determine the other rate constants. And we will have an exercise for that in the demo. Yes. So that will then help to illustrate how we can determine this. And really, if we know these rate constants, then we know everything what happens to the molecule. Then you can calculate when I excite the molecule, oh, I know how much population goes to different pathways. Okay, now let's go through different categories of processes. Internal conversion. We can have multiple internal conversions. So this is a spin-allowed non-radiative relaxation. And we would like to distinguish SN to S1. So that is relaxation among the excited singlet states or relaxation among the triplet states. But separately, we can discuss this S1 to S0. And it turns out that these relaxations among higher singlet or triplet states, they are about the same rate, but the rate is much higher than for the last one, for the S1 to S0. Typically, this is much slower, S1 to S0, and that is, I will explain soon why. And typically, experimentally, these relaxation rates among higher states is very fast. Rate constant is 10 to 11 to 10 to 13. And that is because typically when we have excited states, we can have many excited states, and they have, so there will be lots of potential energy curves, and there are lots of curve crossings. Because of these curve crossings, we will have very rapid relaxation among higher electronic excited states. So that means that whichever electronic state you excite, higher electronic state, it relaxes very rapid to the S1 state. And that leads to so-called Casas rule, that fluorescence occurs only from S1 to zero. But this is not absolute truth, but it is almost always the case. That even if you excite S2 state, you only observe emission from S1 state, because there is very rapid relaxation. And if the relaxation among the higher electronic states has a rate constant of say 10 to 12, it means that fluorescence essentially only starts when the molecule is relaxed to the S1 state. Same thing, that phosphorescence only occurs from T1 state, not from higher T states. And these emissions from higher electronic states, they are very rare. So this is actually very, very important, because it leads to also Vavilov's rule, that quantum yield of fluorescence and phosphorescence is independent of initial excitation energy. So it doesn't matter which state I excite, I always get the same fluorescence. This is a very powerful principle. Now, energy gap law for internal conversion. And that concerns now especially this S1 and S0. So that is much slower. And why is this? It's because whereas we have multiple curve crossings between many electronic states upstairs, we have a big gap typically between the ground S0 and S1. And typically there is no curve crossing between these. And that's why we have this transponder forbidden transition. And that's why this is usually very slow, S1 to S0. And in fact, you can make an estimation that Frank Condon factor is exponentially dependent on the energy difference between the 0-1 states. So it's exponential dependence. And if we say that the maximum rate would be 10 to 13, we can plug in this exponential dependence. And this leads to so-called energy gap law, that if the energy difference between the S0 and S1 state is more than 200 kilojoules per mole, then internal conversion can be neglected compared to fluorescence or intersystem cross. And this is very often the case. This is not very large. So very often internal conversion can be neglected, so it's very small. So this shows the principle that okay, basically the same thing, the Frank Condon principle, that here we have a big Frank Condon factor, and for higher electronic states we have these crossings, we have a rapid relaxation, but when we have the S1 state, it doesn't have curve crossing, and then we have a small Frank Condon factor, and this is very long lived, and the energy difference here is a key point. Okay, so that is something to remember, that typically S1, so higher electronics, among higher electronic states, relaxation is very rapid. So no matter where you excite, system will be very rapidly on S1 or P1 if it goes into system crossing. And then that internal conversion is very slow to the ground state. What about intersystem crossing? First, we have S1 to T1. Rate varies a lot. It can be very slow, something like 10 to 6 per second, but it can be also very fast, 10 to 11. So there's a big range variation. And when we have rigid molecules, like aromatic hydrocarbons, it is very low because the molecule doesn't vibrate much, and vibrations are small amplitude, and we don't typically induce these curve crossings. For example, naphthalene, anthracene, we have very small rate, so we don't populate triplet state much. But if we have heavy atoms, like bromine, chlorine, even iodine, that leads to large rates. It's because there is very high spin orbit coupling. We don't go into that more detail, but for heavy atoms actually break this singlet triplet rule. So singlet triplet forbiddenness is broken down with heavy atoms. So then we can have very rapid intersystem cross, like bromonaphthalene and benzophenone. Okay, so that means that depending on the molecule, we can populate very efficiently triplet states or not. And we can have, we have to remember that we can have actually two different kind of mechanisms. It's possible that typically we can have S1 to T1 transition directly, but if we have close lying T2 state, it's also possible to have a thermal activation for the T2, and then because T2 relaxes very fast to T1, we have this thermally activated relaxation as well. So we have two components. And the rate constant for ST can follow this equation where we have the ST rate constant plus this term, which is like an Arrhenius equation. So it is thermally activated component also. So that refers to the second pathway, which goes via higher T states. So singlet triplet transitions, the rate can vary a lot. Then we have triplet to singlet, T1 S0. So this is a final transition. So basically the only possible relaxation channels are radiationless or radiative transition. And also there we have these heavy atoms is important and energy difference, but typically now the rate is very, very small. So even from 10 to minus 3, which means that it's macroscopically long lifetime, seconds or minutes, but it can be up to 10 to 3 per second. But in any case, this is much, much slower than the other rates. So it means that if we excite higher states, we have very rapid relaxation to S1. Then we the internal convergence typically is slow, so we mostly relax via fluorescence, or we can have KST. It can be very high, so we populate efficiently T1 state, but that is then very long lived, and we will mostly see phosphorescence over long time, unless we have quench. Okay, so this. Now, so in this kind of diagram, we basically see all possible relaxation pathways, and they are multiple. There are radiative and non-radiative, and we have all the time always also vibrational relaxation occurring. And this diagram emphasizes the electronic states only, but there is always this vibrational relaxation. And in the end, all the energy, excitation energy, goes either to heat or to light. Okay, so now we close this photophysics part. So all this is called photophysics because we have physical processes and there is no chemistry. So we end up in the S0 state in here. So finally, nothing happened. We just pump energy and that energy dissipated somehow. But of course, we have photochemistry. So and that we did not discuss. So the excited state molecule can undergo reactions. And then we have a chemical reaction. But this is, of course, vast field itself. So we can have all kinds of reactions. And that is topic of another course. And of course, the excited state molecule is more reactive than the ground state molecule. So they are reactive molecules. Okay, but now we go to the second topic of today, which is photoelectron spectroscopy. And the principle relies on now going again higher in energy than what we had in electronic spectroscopy, going so high that actually we rip out electron from the molecule total. So we induce photoionization. So we create free electron and cation. And we can define threshold energy. So H nu threshold, so certain energy where we barely just remove electron from the material, but we don't put kinetic energy. So this is the threshold when we can take electron out, and this is called work function if we talk about metals or materials. So this is a minimum energy that is needed to remove electron. If we put more energy, that energy goes to kinetic energy of electron. So then electron will get kinetic energy. So we can write in this way that H nu, so energy of the photon, is equal to work function plus half times mv squared, where m is the mass of electron and v is the velocity. So basically we generate fast electrons if we put more energy. Do you know who got the Nobel Prize for this effect? Yeah. So it's very important. Now, in chemistry, we don't talk about work function often when we worry about molecules. So then we talk about ionization energy. This is more familiar to us. So if we have gas phase samples, we talk about ionization energy. But the principle is the same. So it's ionization energy is the minimum energy needed to remove electron from the molecule. And the rest goes to kinetic energy of electrons. Now, so for electronic spectroscopy, we used visible and ultraviolet radiation. And that covers the range of electronic excitations. If we want to remove electron, we have to put more energy and we go to deep UV or X-rays. And now, depending on what energy we use, we can perform different kind of ionizations. And they have specific characteristics. So we divide this into three ranges. UPS, ultraviolet photoelectron spectroscopy. So if you use deep UV radiation, we can ionize. And here we ionize valence electrons, because valence electrons are not so deeply bound. But if we want to ionize the core electrons, they are much more strongly bound. We need more energetic radiation, and then we have to go to X-ray. And that is X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, and it is abbreviated as XPS. This is nowadays a very useful technique used in material and nanoscience. Unfortunately, we don't have XPS technique here in nanoscience, but we do use this via collaborations. And the third technique is called Auger electron spectroscopy, and that refers to so-called secondary electrons. It means that we kick out core electron, but because it's very high energy process, we have a filling of a hole, and energy release is used to kick out second electron. So we kick actually two or more electrons with one X-ray photon. So, and there is a very simple selection rule, which is that all ionizations are possible because electron can take away any amount of momentum. So no rules. Okay, this illustrates the different processes. So here, these are electronic states now. orbital speed. Let's speak as orbital. And note that, so these refer to core orbitals. And this gap here is actually much, much larger than what is shown here. This should be actually much, much larger. These are much more deeply bound. And these are the valence orbitals. So what is the typical binding energy of electron in valence orbitals? What kind of magnitude we are talking about in terms of electron volts? Any idea?
Yeah.
Yeah, so typical ionization energy, we are talking about around 1 to 10 electron volts. But core orbitals are hundreds of electron volts. So it's very different. And now if we kick out some of the valence orbital electrons with this UPS, if we kick out the core orbital electrons with this XPS, and then here the process is such that we kick the core electron away, and then another electron from higher valence orbital drops to the created hole, and this is a large energy, and that energy is dissipated via ejection of another electron. So basically, we eject more electrons than one. So how to measure? What is done in an experiment is that we have a sample, and it is typically irradiated with monochromatic photons. So one energy of photons, and then we get electrons out, and we analyze the kinetic energy of electrons. So there is some kind of electron energy analyzer, which is typically has an electric field, which bends the electrons, and then there is a slit which selects those electrons which has a certain kinetic energy, and then recorder which records the number of electrons per unit time. And then you move the slit or change the electric field so that you can record number of electrons at different kinetic energies. Okay, so let's start going through first UPS, and the simplest case is atoms. So as an example, we take argon atom, and here we refer to the electron configuration. You remember argon is a closed shell, so we have K shell, L shell field, and then 3s2, 3p6, closed shell atom. If you kick out the electron, we get argon plus, where the lowest ionization occurs from the p orbital. So we have 3p5, which can be treated as a hole, one hole, electron hole on p orbital. And so we kick the electron to the continuum. And so here is the spectrum. So in the spectrum is typically formed by plotting the kinetic energy and number of electrons occurring at certain kinetic energies. And now if there is, usually it is changed to ionization energy. So when we subtract, I will show you, for example, here. So if we want to plot ionization energy, we take the excitation energy and subtract the kinetic energy, okay? So we measure first kinetic energy, but then we plot initial energy minus kinetic energy, and then we get ionized energy. Okay. And so when we do this, we see two peaks. And now we have to understand why we see two peaks. And I have labeled these two peaks with symbols which resemble symbols we had for diatomic molecule electronic states. And they are indeed very similar. Unfortunately, we did not go through atomic spectroscopy, and where you would know immediately what this means, but I explain it here. So we have to remember that we have to consider now the final state. So for the initial state, we have only one state, the ground state. But for the final state, we have now one hole on p orbital. So we have to consider what kind of states we can have for the ion. And we have actually two states. And it refers again to the angular momentum. So remember, in the final state, we have one hole, which can be considered like one electron. And that electron has angular momentum, and it has a spin. And we have two states, parallel, spin and angular momentum, or antiparallel. And they are two different angular momentum states. So we should have two different states. These are the two states. And this term symbol has a main label, P, which refers to the angular momentum, similarly to the diatomic molecules we have. So it is a one unit of angular momentum. And then we have the, on the left, multiplicity. You remember one electron or one hole. This multiplicity is two. Okay, so the multiplicity, angular momentum, and the right-hand lowercase, lower index is total angular momentum. So if they are parallel or antiparallel. So, and we see that at low ionization energy, we have total angular momentum of 3/2, and the higher one is total angular momentum of 1/2. So it shows that parallel state is lower in energy, and the antiparallel is higher. So it shows that we can, so we should have two different ionizations referring to these two different final states. And from this kind of spectrum, elsewhere we don't see anything because there is no state. And from this spectrum, we can determine very accurately ionization energies for atoms and even referring to different electronic states of the final state. So now here is the gas ionization energies. And we have measured, or people have measured for argon, you know, very accurately the ionizations for different states. Because we always have to remember that we have to consider the final state. And here we have two different final states. This understood, right? So this is very important technique, because with this technique we can measure these ionization energies, which is very important in chemistry. Okay. Right. There is intensity ratio. This is about twice the intensity of this. It comes from degeneracy. This J 3/2 state is 4-fold degenerate, and J 1/2 state is doubly degenerate. Again, referring to this magnetic quantum number. So basically, if J is 3/2, we can have magnetic quantum number minus 3/2, minus 1/2, plus 1/2, plus 3/2. So 4 states. For 1/2, we have only 1/2 or minus 1/2 for 2 states. So degeneracy factor explains the intensity. Okay, what about molecules? Now, simple molecule hydrogen. We have exactly the same principle as for electronic spectroscopy. We have ground state, neutral hydrogen molecule, and we have excited state. But this time, excited state is not excited state of hydrogen, but it's cation. It is the ground electronic state of the cation, H2+. And as you can guess, it has a equilibrium distance larger than for H2 because we remove the bonding electron, and it has this characteristic vibrational structure. So we should see something similar to electronic spectroscopy, and indeed we see it. So this now shows the ionization energies. So we have a nice progression of basically vibronic transitions, but now we just have to remember the final state is the H2+ cation. And we can assign the spectrum. These are expanded spectra on the left, showing that we can see transitions to very high limit, up to 14, 15, 16 vibration states. And now we see that this technique can be used to determine accurately vibrational properties of cations, also very important information. So we get understanding of bonding. So basically same principle as with electronic spectroscopy, we see vibronic transitions. And this also defines, now we can define two different ionization energies for molecule, this concept molecule. So-called adiabatic ionization energy, which refers to V prime is zero minus V prime prime is zero. So basically lowest energy transition. So energy difference between the lowest states of the neutral and cation. So that is an energy difference. That is called adiabatic ionization energy. Or we can determine vertical ionization energy, ionization at Frank Condon maximum. So basically, here it would be equal to V prime is 2. And the point is that, well, here it's maybe not so useful, but if you don't resolve this fibronic structure, but you see, it may be this kind of spectrum, and then you take the maximum and define that as a vertical ionization. Because maybe you don't see at all, maybe your 0, 0 would be here, so you cannot determine, but you can determine the maximum. You see the difference? So this is like kind of like a thermodynamical ionization energy. But sometimes in a spectrum, you don't observe this transition at all. So it's easier to define this maximum of the spectrum. Here's another example, nitrogen. So now this illustrates ionization from different orbitals. Okay. So here is the neutral nitrogen molecule configuration. Sigma star 2 electrons, pi ungerade 4 electrons, sigma gerade 2 electrons, and the state. Now, here is a spectrum starting from the right, which is the lowest ionization occurs here. And that refers to ionization of the highest energy orbital, sigma gerade. Okay? But then there is empty, and then another spectrum appears, and that spectrum refers to ionization from the pi orbital, okay? And then again, empty, and finally, a third spectrum appears, and that is ionization from the sigma ungerade star, so antibonding orbital. So in the same spectrum, you can see ionization from different orbitals. And now, since we see the vibrational spectra, we can determine the vibrational properties of upper state, and we can analyze bond distances, and you can see, for example, that when we take electron from the antibonding orbital, the bond distance gets even shorter than for the neutral state. So this is even strongly, more strongly bound, NP plus, when you take the electron from the antibonding orbital. But if you take it from the bonding orbital, you get longer bond distance. So reasonable. So all this, all our knowledge on cation states is obtained from this kind of UPS experience. So this is very important technique. And of course, when you go to complex molecules, we have multiple vibrations. We can have different vibrations. So it gets, the spectra get more complicated. Now we go to XPS. So that was, so UPS refers to the, now we ionized valence electrons. Now we start to ionize core electrons. And now it's important to understand that core electrons, they are almost the same for elements and for molecules, elements and molecules. So they don't, core electrons are almost, orbitals are almost the same if the molecule is, if the atom is in the molecule or if it's a free atom. So these are atomic-like states, very much. But there is slight difference. So the neighboring atoms modify the state slightly. And because of that, we do see small difference in the positions of ionizations. And that is called chemical shift. And that gives us information about the chemical environment of these elements. Here's an example. Mixture of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. And here are two different ranges. And now look at the scale. This is ionization energy now in electron volts. We go from 300 to 500 electron volts. So this is very, very different than 10 to 15 for the UPS. And on the left, we have ionization of oxygen, 1s core electron. And we do see two peaks. One refers to CO, one to CO2. So it shows that we have small difference between oxygens in different molecules, but you see that it's not much. The scale here is from 540 to 545. So it means that the difference is about 1 electron volt, 1 to 2 electron volts. Whereas the absolute value is 500. So it's a small difference. On the right, same thing for carbon 1s ionization. So it occurs around 300 electron volts. And also there we can see the difference in chemical environment. So this means that with this technique, we can distinguish between different chemical compositions. So formally, we can define chemical shift as a delta E, so energy difference. It refers to energy difference or ionization in a molecule, ionization energy in a molecule minus ionization energy in the atom. And this is on the order of 1 electron volt. Here is an example of a complicated molecule where we have carbon, XPS spectra, and we have 1, 2, 3, 4 different kinds of chemical environments for carbon atoms. And now this is plotted in terms of chemical shift, where zero shift is at 291 electron volts. And then we can see that we can see all these different chemical environments as a separate peak. And the chemical shift goes up to about 8 electron volts. So this is a range where we can see differences between chemical environments. So it's a good analytic technique. Mostly XPS is used for solids and materials. It's very sensitive technique. Here's, for example, gold foil with adsorbed mercury, 0.1% of a monolayer. So we do, these are the peaks of gold atoms in gold material, but we can see mercury peaks even with a very small coverage. So it's a sensitive surface technique. For example, we have been doing with the collaborators XPS of graphene oxide, and graphene is a monolayer of graphene, and we can see the signals from graphene oxide groups in XPS technique. There are not too many techniques that can observe or get information from a monolayer. So that means that we can investigate very sensitively even monolayer properties and the chemical composition. Auger spectroscopy. So we kick out a core electron and we get another electron we measure. So we get also secondary electrons. So in principle, it's the same technique as XPS, but we do get secondary electrons and we can measure those energies as well. And so because the electron penetration depth is about 2 nanometers, this is also a surface analysis technique. So very sensitive technique. And this shows the principle. First, we kick out the core electron from K, and then in very rapid time scale, electron from 2s, so L shell falls to the K to fill the K hole. And this is a large energy, and that energy difference is enough to kick out another electron. And we can measure both electrons. And that tells us, gives us information. We refer to this as KL1, KL2 process, referring to K refers to the initial electron. Second, L refers to the process where the electron falls to the low energy orbital. And the third one tells us from which orbital electron, a secondary electron is ejected. Here is an example of Auger electrons for sulfur-containing gas, also showing the chemical shift. But these are now the secondary electrons that we are measuring. So basically, very similar technique as this XPS, but now just this occur at different energies because they are secondary electrons. Here is an example of a practical use. This is a messy picture, but the message here is that so this is Auger spectrum of magnesium, a material where we have a magnesium surface and it is gently oxidized in time and one follows the oxidation process with Auger spectroscopy. So basically, here are the peaks, the spectrum of magnesium. Here down here is spectrum of magnesium oxide. And in the middle is the then partially oxidized magnesium. So you can see that we do see both magnesium and magnesium oxide peaks. And now from the evolution of this spectrum, we can investigate how magnesium metal is oxidized gradually, as an example. So all kinds of surface reactions can be observed and followed with this technique. Finally, we have X-ray fluorescence. So these processes are basically measuring electrons, but we can also have fluorescence, X-ray fluorescence, similar to normal fluorescence. But of course, it's very high energy now. So we have X-ray fluorescence. And now, because we have fluorescence between bound states of electrons, we have selection rules again. Delta N can be anything. Delta L plus minus one and delta J zero plus minus one. So now selection rules are similar as with atomic spectroscopy. Now, chemical shift is very small because we have transition between two bound states, and for both states we have chemical shift, and usually it is very similar for both. So the shift is kind of eliminated. Whereas in XPS, because we generate the free electron, we do see the chemical shift. But here we have a transition between two states, and both have similar chemical shifts. So this is primarily elemental analysis technique. This diagram shows various transitions, allowed transitions. So we do get emission between different core orbitals. And as an example, we can see the J half, 4s J half state can emit to J half state. So delta J is zero. Or we can have a, let's say, J is five halves goes to V half. So delta J is one. And so on. So all these transitions, they obey the selection rules. And this just shows that we can have these transitions similarly to normal UV emission spectroscopy of fluorescence. And this is an example of X-ray fluorescence spectrum of gold, showing many sharp peaks. And so this is a very useful technique for elemental analysis. Nowadays, even there are handheld instruments where you can basically measure X-ray fluorescence from various samples, and you can determine the concentrations of different elements. And I showed you previously example of how we did analysis of pigments of paintings with the Raman spectroscopy. Now this technique also is much used for that kind of applications. You can determine the elemental composition of, for example, pigments from paintings. Okay, good. That's it. We are in the end. Any questions?
We most often have that S0, S1, and P1, but some molecules are triplet state of the branches, so would we have like triplet zero, triplet one, and then singlet?
Yes, indeed. So this is a customary way to write this, because in most of the molecules are on the zero singlet state. But of course, like oxygen, we have some molecules which are triplet. It's very rare. That's why we don't use that. But you are right. Then we would have a triplet zero, and then we would have a triplet one state. So it would be kind of reversed. That's correct. Yeah. Good question. Anything else? No? Okay, so good. Thanks. And tomorrow is the test.
Yeah.